Hey, like I said, worksheets are out there on the counter. If you want a worksheet, we'll be looking at Daniel chapter 5. And I titled this Pride and Blasphemy because this is about a fellow by the name of Belshazzar, who was the king of Babylon. He was, in fact, the last king of Babylon. And let me get all my ducks in order here. So what I want to do first of all is we'll go ahead and read a little bit of this passage, and then we'll go into our study. It says here in Daniel chapter 5, starting in verse 1, it says, Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. Belshazzar, whiles he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines might drink therein. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem, and the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines drank in them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. Okay, I'm going to give you a little bit of historical background before we actually get into this. And there's a reason for this. First of all, on your worksheet, Nebuchadnezzar died in 562 BC. He was that head of gold that he dreamt about in Daniel chapter 2. And he reigned roughly about 43 years, including the 7 years of his insanity that we studied about last time we went through Daniel. Now, following Nebuchadnezzar was his son. In the history books, he's called Emel-Marduk, but in your Bible, he's known as Evil-Merodach. Evil-Merodach, E-V-I-L-M-E-R-O-D-A-C-H. And this man only reigned for 2 years, and you can read about him in 2 Kings chapter 25 and Jeremiah 52. And it was Evil-Merodach that showed kindness to Jehoiachin, who was a king of Jerusalem. And he was the fellow who freed Jehoiachin from prison and elevated him in Babylon. We read that in 2 Kings 25, 27 through 30. In verse 27, it says, in the 12th month, on the 7th and 20th day of the month, that Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, in the year that he began to reign, did lift up the head of Jehoiachin, king of Judah, out of prison. And he spake kindly unto him. So he released Jehoiachin out of prison. So that's his claim to fame. And then 2 years later, his brother-in-law, a man by the name of Neri Glasser, N-E-R-I-G-L-A-S-S-A-R, murdered Evil-Merodach, and then usurped the throne and ruled in Babylon for about 4 years. Neri Glasser, and I'm sure I'm butchering the man's name, he's also mentioned in Jeremiah chapter 39, verses 3 and verses 13, and he's known there as Nergal-Sharezer. I know, it's a mouthful. But that you can read about him in Jeremiah 39, 13. And he is the fellow who is had a part in releasing Jeremiah from prison when they imprisoned Jeremiah there in Jerusalem. So he was one of the princes. And then he later became king after he murdered his brother-in-law. Then after Nergal-Sharezer died, his son, by a man by the name of Labashai Marduk, L-A-B-A-S-H-I, Marduk, M-A-R-D-U-K. Now, he was still a boy when he began to reign, and he didn't last very long. He only reigned for about 9 months, and he was just one of those puppet rulers, like you read sometimes in the Kings of Israel, when you have a young man who comes to the throne. You know, he pretty much does what other people tell him. This is what Labash-Marduk was. And then a man by the name of Nabonidus, N-A-B-O-N-I-D-U-S, he killed, he was a murderer. He murdered this young man in 556 B.C., and he reigned for some 17 years, and I think that's all on your worksheet. Okay, for many years, and this is the point that I gave you all of this with these jaw-breaking names. For many, many years, one of the big criticisms of the book of Daniel was that there was no man such as Belshazzar, who was the king of Babylon. That's what they claimed. They couldn't find his name anywhere, so Daniel had to be a fake document. This name had to be made up because there was nobody by the name of Belshazzar that they could find that became king of Babylon. So they, because the critics couldn't find it, they said, "Well, it can't be true." Well, generally, what the critics deny, the archaeological shovel turns over and proves the Bible right every time. Every time it proves the Bible right. In 1854, and that's not in your notes, but this is just one of those dry, dusty history things. In 1854, a fellow by the name of Sir Henry Rawlinson found inscriptions in the ruins of a town called Umgir that contained accounts of Nabonidus, and he had a son by the name of Belshazzar. He had a son by the name of Belshazzar, and lo and behold, his son shared in the government of Nabonidus. Okay? So there's his name. In 1920, another inscription was found that connected, again, Nabonidus and Belshazzar. So his name is starting to come up. Then in 1958, a professor, Karl Oberhuber, of the University of Innsbruck, found some cuneiform texts from Babylon, and he began to translate these texts, and lo and behold, he came up with this line in the text that said, "Belshazzar, prince of Babylonia under Nabonidus." And so what this text does is confirms that this Belshazzar did exist, and even more importantly, these cuneiform texts were dated in 6 BC, the very time that Daniel lived, and the very time that Daniel wrote this down for our Bibles. So the Bible is always right. It's always right. And so what the connection here is that they found out that this Nabonidus was married to a daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, who then gave birth to this Belshazzar of Daniel chapter 5. So there's the connection with Belshazzar with Nebuchadnezzar. There's the connection. Now, Nabonidus, he was the kind of king who, he liked to travel around his kingdom. And so what he would like to do is he'd set up his capital in different parts of the kingdom, all right? Kind of like Mr. Trump has his home down in Florida, right? He preferred the climate in other parts of the kingdom rather than Babylon. So when he was away from Babylon, guess who was in charge? Belshazzar. And in fact, Nabonidus at one time spent 14 years away from Babylon. So when it calls Belshazzar the king of Babylon in the book of Daniel, that is absolutely correct. Because he was. He was serving as king in Babylon while his father Nabonidus was traveling all over the kingdom. Okay? So that's that history. That's that history. So verse 1, we see the king. He made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. And you know, the kings of the Orient were famous for their banquets. We read a little bit about that in the book of Esther, don't we? Yeah, because that's what was going on in the book of Esther. There was a big party there that was going on as well. And according to historians, as they've looked at all these writings and everything, they found out that Belshazzar was a very lewd and vulgar man, exactly the way that Daniel portrays him in this chapter. So even history tells us that Belshazzar was a very lewd, very vulgar man who was given to drink and all sorts of, we're in polite company, but he just involved himself in a lot of things that he shouldn't have been involved in. So he's a very lugal man. He was the typical spoiled royal brat. Let's put it that way. All right? So what Daniel says of this man fits the historical story of this man. And so on the very night these lords and ladies were having this banquet outside the walls of Babylon, the Medes and the Persians were gathering their troops and they were already laying siege to the city. Okay, so while this banquet was going on, picture in your mind, the king and all of these folks were having a party, and on the outside of the walls, the enemy forces were already camped out and ready to attack. That's what was going on here. And indeed, Babylon was a mighty fortress city. Its walls were considered impregnable. You could drive two chariots around the walls. They were so high and thick. They claimed that they had enough food stored in the city that they could last out a 20-year siege. I mean, they had fields and vineyards and everything inside the city that they could grow their food, and they had animals. So they claimed that they could outlast a 20-year siege. So they thought they were safe behind the walls. I mean, why worry about the enemy when you're comfortable, right? When you're safe and secure. Why worry about the enemy? They were like the proverbial frog in a pot. You know what happens to a frog as you increase the heat? It perishes. It perishes. It doesn't have enough sense to hop out. Well, that's what these folks were doing. And these lords and ladies, if you want to call them that, these princes, his concubines, and his wives, they were having a big party. Now, here's an interesting historical fact. You know the reason why those princes and those lords and ladies were there? Well, they were a bunch of cowards. Instead of staying and defending their various regions that they were responsible for, they hightailed it to the capital city to save their own skins and let their own people perish under the armies of the Medes and the Persians. So instead of standing there, instead of standing up against the Medes and the Persians, they ran to the capital city to save their own hides. That's why they were there. That's why they were there. And so the more drunk they became, the more confident they became. The more confident they became, the more lewd they became. And the more lewd they became, then their thinking started going down a bad path. And I'm thinking at the very height of their debauchery, Belshazzar has a drunken epiphany. And he gives the command, he shouts out, he says, "Hey guys, I've got a great idea. Let's get all the vessels from that Jewish temple and let's drink out of those vessels and praise our gods." Drinking from those vessels. So his overindulgence fueled his indifference that degenerated into irreverence. What's true of a man is true of a nation. What's true of a man is true of a nation. And honestly, this crowd could not possibly have perpetrated a more insulting and degrading show of blasphemy than to bring in those holy vessels that were used in the service of the temple in worship to God, and involve these vessels in this drunken orgy, because that's exactly what it was. That's exactly what it was. It was a drunken orgy. Now look here in Daniel 5, 4. It says, they drank wine and did what? Praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. Now the question might be asked, of all the vessels that these guys could have chosen from, of all the vessels that Belshazzar could have said, let's bring in all the vessels from, say, the gods of the Phoenicians, why did he choose Jehovah? Why did he choose those vessels? Well, I'm going to give you some suggestions, okay? And they're on your worksheet. These are some suggestions. First of all, we learned from this chapter that Belshazzar was fully aware of Nebuchadnezzar's dealings with the God of the Jews. All right? He was aware of the dealings of Nebuchadnezzar with the God of the Jews. He knew about Nebuchadnezzar's dream. He knew about Nebuchadnezzar's humility. He knew about all that. And we're going to see that in this chapter because he's reminded of what he knew. The second thing is, even as the Medo-Persian army began to encircle the city, this foolish man dared defy Daniel's God by desecrating the holy vessels of the temple in Jerusalem. So defy and desecrating would be the two words. And here's the reason why. You see, he boasted that his gods of gold, silver, brass, and iron, wood, and stone, those tangible material things, were more powerful than some invisible deity, and that's what's in your blank, invisible deity that only shows up in dreams and visions to disturb the sleep of kings. That's not any different than a lot of folks today. Thinking that the tangible is more powerful than God Almighty. And like his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar before him, Belshazzar was prideful of his capital city and overconfident about his power. You see, the very act of drinking from the golden vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, this was a boast of Belshazzar against Jehovah God. Because he knew what God had shown his father Nebuchadnezzar. And in essence, what Belshazzar did was he thumbed his snotty, spoiled nose at the Most High God. That's what he did. That's what he did. That's not a very smart thing to do. I don't care who you are. I don't care who you are. Psalms 59:12 says, for the sin of their mouth and the words of their lips, let them even be taken in their pride. And for cursing and lying which they speak, consume them in their wrath, in wrath consume them that they may not be, and let them know that God ruleth in Jacob unto the ends of the earth. And he will know. That night he will know. And Belshazzar is a shadow of the one to come that's going to do the very same thing in that future temple in Jerusalem. When he stands up and defies God and claims himself to be his God. 2 Thessalonians 2:3, he says, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. That's exactly what Belshazzar did when he desecrated those vessels from Jehovah's temple. He elevated himself above the Most High God in this act of blasphemy and defiance. It was an irreverent show of contempt for Daniel's God. He was so confident in his impregnable fortress city. He was so confident in his highly trained siege troops. He was so confident in his provisions that would last for 20 years. He was so confident in the material that he felt powerful enough to challenge the King of Heaven. That's pride. What's that verse in 1 Thessalonians 5:3 say? For when they shall say peace and safety, sudden destruction cometh upon them. That's exactly what happened here with Belshazzar. What is it? There's four things. You don't pull on Superman's cape. You don't spit in the wind. You don't pull on the mask of the old ranger, and you don't blaspheme God. You can only blaspheme God for so long. And then one of these days, he'll knock that little chip off your shoulder. And that's what he's doing here with Belshazzar. Now, of course, we know that every party, there's always a wet blanket. Right? At every party, there's always a wet blanket. And guess what? A wet blanket showed up at Belshazzar's party. An uninvited guest. Look at Daniel 5:5. In the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him so that the joints of his loins were loosed and his knees smote against one another. So as Belshazzar and his drunken companion were having a good laugh at the expense of God, lo and behold, who shows up? Who shows up? I believe in the most obvious place this finger began writing on a wall, probably right in front of where Belshazzar was sitting, and began writing on the wall. You know, that's where that saying comes from. They're so dumb they can't even see the writing on the wall. That's where it comes from. So in your worksheet here, seeing this supernatural sight had a very dramatic effect upon this man and his fellow party hardy gals and pals. First of all, it says his countenance changed. His countenance changed from a leering, boastful drunkard to a sober, sniveling coward. His countenance changed. Then it says his thoughts troubled. He went from not having a care in the world, right? All safe and secure in his fortress city, and now he's a frightened man. He's a frightened man. It says here the joints of his loins loosed. That's just a very polite way of saying that he lost control of his bowels. He lost control of his bowels. And then it says his knees smote. So from standing strong in his drunken courage, now his knees started knocking together like crazed castanets. Right? Just banging together. What a sight this guy must have been. I mean, talk about sobering up quick. Talk about sobering up quick. From a bragging drunkard, to now, this frightened little boy, and that's exactly what he was. Hebrews 10:31 says, it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And that's exactly where Belshazzar was that night. It was the finger. I want to say some things about the finger of God. This is in your worksheet. It was the finger of God that delivered Israel from their bondage in Egypt. That'll be on your worksheet. It was the finger of God that wrote the commandments in stone before Moses. It was the finger of God that Jesus cast out demons by. And now it's the finger of God writing out judgment upon this debauched king and his city and his empire. The finger of God. Daniel 5:7, we read, the king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. And the king spake and said to the wise men of Babylon, whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. So the first thing he does is he starts screaming for the wise guys. Bring in the learned men of Babylon. Bring in the learned men of Babylon. Again, that's exactly what a worldling does. They look to the world to get their answer. He looks to the world to get his answer, and the only answer he's going to get is from a man of God. But this is what the worldling does. They always look to the world for their answer that only God can provide them. That only God can provide them. And notice what he says here. He says that there'll be whoever answers this riddle, he says, shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Now remember what we studied? That makes perfect sense if you understand the history. You had Nabonidus, his father, who was first in line. Then you had himself, Belshazzar, who was second in line. And then whosoever would answer this riddle of his would be number three. Just like history, just like the Bible puts it out. So in come all the king's wise men, verse 8. But they could not read the writing nor make known to the king the interpretation thereof. Again, we see that the world cannot offer the answers that only God can provide. These men were expert in their field. They had all their fancy books, their astrology. They read the entrails of animals, all of that occultism that they were involved in, and yet they could not come to the truth. They couldn't find out what this writing was all about on the wall. Proverbs 25:14 says, the secret of the Lord is with them that fear him, and he will show them his covenant. None of these guys feared the true Lord, the true God of heaven. So they didn't have the answers. They didn't have the answers. In verse 9, then was King Belshazzar greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed in him, and his lords were astonished. So when his wise men failed him, that just simply intensified his fear. It intensified his anxiety. He went to those folks who he believed would have the answers that he needed, but they didn't have those answers. And so that simply intensified his fear and his anxiety. We see the same thing today. When they go to folks that they think have the answer, and these people don't have the answer, there's no comfort in that. There's no hope in that, is there? It's only fear. It's only fear. You know, that's a terrible place to be. That's a terrible place to be. To have willingly lived in darkness, having all your life rejected God's word, having all your life turned your back on the light, and when you need light, and you go to those places where you think that light can be found, and you find out that that light isn't there for you, you're still left in darkness. You're left with no hope. That's a very frightening place to be. And when you do get the light from God's word, instead of providing you hope, it condemns you. It condemns you. That's a terrible place to be. Many, many years ago, I went to went on a hospital visit. And a friend of mine had a friend who all their lifetime rejected the gospel. And my friend was a very good personal witness. And this friend of hers was on her deathbed in the hospital. And so she wanted me to go and speak to this person. So I went to this person and spoke to them and shared out of the Word of God, the gospel, and how God loved her and how God would pardon her and how God's grace was available to her, and even on her deathbed, she resisted. She found no comfort because she had rejected that light all her life. Proverbs 1:27, when your fear cometh as desolation and your destruction cometh as a whirlwind, when distress and anguish cometh upon you, then shall they call upon me, but I will not answer. They shall seek me early, but they shall not find me. For that they hated knowledge, it did not choose the fear of the Lord. That woman passed off into eternity rejecting the light. That's not a good place to be. So seeing these dumbfounded faces of his counselors, Belshazzar became more and more distraught. It was seen in his face. It was seen in his body language. So much so that his fear and his anxiety was transferred to those wise men and his princes and all those people in the room. And it says that they were astonished. That means to be stunned. It means to become like stone. I mean, have you ever heard somebody say, I was so frightened I couldn't move? That's where they were at. That's where they were at. At one time, they were laughing and mocking God, and now they're in abject fear, frozen in place. Frozen in place. And it not only affected that room that they were at, but it like a stone dropped in the middle of a pond, the fear rippled throughout the palace. And news spread throughout the palace about what was going on in that banquet hall. And then news came to somebody who knew God's dealings with Nebuchadnezzar. Look here in verse 10. Now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house because she heard the uproar. And the queen spake and said, O king, live forever. Let not thy thoughts trouble thee, nor let thy countenance be changed. There is a man in thy kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him. Whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, the king, I say, thy father made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. For as much as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding, interpreting of dreams and showing of hard sentences and dissolving of doubts were found in the same Daniel, whom the king named Belshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. Now a lot of conjecture is, who is this woman? Well, she wasn't Belshazzar's wife because he had all of his wives, plural, and even his concubines in that banqueting hall. No, this woman here is his mom. This is the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, whom his father Nabonidus had married. And the evidence is very strong that this woman was around. I mean, you hear it from her own testimony. She was around when her father, Nebuchadnezzar, had dealings with Daniel. And the images and everything that he went through. I mean, chronologically, only 23 years have gone by since Nebuchadnezzar's death. So that's not that long ago. That's not that long ago. And so she comes in here and she's got this firsthand knowledge about Daniel. And so he informs Belshazzar about Daniel. When she hears this disturbance going on, she comes into the banquet hall, and in the fashion of the court, she goes, O king, live forever. How well did that work? O king, live forever. And then she tells Belshazzar, call for Daniel. Call for Daniel. I wonder if there's not a little bit of a rebuke in her voice. You know? You knucklehead. Why don't you call Daniel? Why don't you call Daniel? Now, I don't know. Maybe Belshazzar didn't like somebody like Daniel hanging around. Maybe he didn't like somebody like Daniel hanging around that would preach at him all the time. Preach at him. Remember wicked King Ahab? He was that way. He didn't like to have those righteous prophets around him because they made him feel uncomfortable. But he was in a fix, wasn't he? His wise men failed him. His lords were panicking. His party was ruined. So he takes the queen's advice and he calls for Daniel. Look here at verse 13. Then was Daniel brought in before the king, and the king spake and said unto Daniel, art thou that Daniel, which art of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king my father brought out of Jewry? I have even heard of thee, that the spirit of the gods is in thee, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. And now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known unto me the interpretation thereof. But they could not show the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of thee that thou canst make interpretations and dissolve doubts. Now if thou canst read the writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, thou shalt be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about thy neck and shalt be the third ruler in the kingdom. So Belshazzar informs Daniel of his situation, the inability of his wise men to interpret the writing on the wall. He tells Daniel that he's familiar with his reputation. He knows what kind of man he is. He even flatters Daniel a little bit, as this type would often do. And he even offers the same reward to Daniel that he offered to the wise men. You know, you'll become the third ruler in the kingdom if you can answer this puzzle for me. So what is Daniel's response? In verse 17, then Daniel answered and said before the king, let thy gifts be to thyself, and give thy rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king and make known to him the interpretation. Now notice that when Daniel comes in here to speak with this man, he doesn't do as the queen did. He doesn't begin his discourse with this man with saying, O king, live forever, does he? I don't know about you, but if I was Belshazzar, I would take that as a red flag. Why didn't Daniel say, O king, live forever? Because he knew, didn't he? He knew the king's time was up. What we're going to see when we go like Daniel chapter 7 and Daniel chapter 8, you're going to see when he starts off that chapter in the third year of Belshazzar. You see, Daniel had already gotten those visions ahead of time. So Daniel already knew what the score was when he walked into that banquet hall, because God had already revealed to him in Daniel chapter 7 and Daniel chapter 8 what was coming down. So he went in knowing what the score was. He knew the outcome. He knew the outcome. And he refused those gifts, those rewards offered because of that. He knew what was going down. He knew what was going down. And so what Daniel does is he begins to preach a sermon. In verse 18, he says, O thou king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him, whom he would slew, and whom he would he kept alive, and whom he would he set up, and whom he would he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointeth over it whomsoever he will. And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this, but hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou and thy lords, thy wives, and thy concubines have drunk wine in them, and thou hast praised the gods of silver and of gold, of brass, of iron, wood, and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know, and the God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified. Then was the part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was written. He preached a sermon there, didn't he? He preached a sermon. He began stating the truth that the very God you insulted is the very God that not only set your father up in his place, but also gives you the breath that you're breathing in your lungs. This man, Daniel, taught this man a lesson. With great authority comes great accountability. And you blew it. You blew it. And Daniel gives him a history lesson, reminding him that this very same God whom he blasphemed and mocked and desecrated his vessels with was the very same God that established Nebuchadnezzar on the throne. And this Daniel rebuked this man for being foolish and prideful in comparison to his father Nebuchadnezzar. And essentially what he said was, you're not half the man your father was. And there's no son that likes to hear that, especially a rebellious son. And then Daniel gives Belshazzar the strongest language of condemnation. It was a message of condemnation. It was a message of condemnation. He said, right there in verse 27, or verse 22, though thou knewest all this, Belshazzar, you knew. This was what made his sacrilege even more detestable. This is what thumbing his nose at God made it such a blasphemous action on his part. Because he knew. He knew. This prideful man who was proud about his city and proud about his troops and proud about his wealth, he knew. And what he did in his knowledge is this. In his pride, he exalted himself against God. And this is on your worksheet. Where is it at? Pride is a direct attack upon God. Maybe it's not in your worksheet. Is it? Pride, in its various forms, is a direct assault on God. It is. A prideful person believes themselves independent of any other authority than themselves. They recognize no other authority but themselves. They come to believe in their own minds that they are the authority, don't they? Sure they do. With this thinking, they place themselves at the center of their thoughts, at the center of their influence. It kind of reminds me of somebody else. With the five I wills. When Lucifer, in his pride, rebelled, that was a direct assault upon God. It's no different with us. with our own pride. James 4:6 says, but he giveth more grace, wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. The word resisteth is an interesting word. It's like setting up your troops against an attacking force. And that's what God does to the prideful. He sets up his troops against the prideful. He sets up his troops against the prideful. So be careful. Why do you think in Proverbs 6:16-19, why do you think God puts pride at the top of his hate list? It's an abomination in the eyes of God. Verse 26 of Daniel 5, this is the interpretation of the thing. He says, Mene, God hath... Is it on? Okay. Can you hear me? Okay. Repeat. Start from verse one. I don't think these people would put up with that. They're barely making it through verse 26. Okay, verse 26, Daniel chapter 5 is where we're at. Yeah, that's what I'm getting ready to go into right now. Yep. Yeah, that's what I'm getting ready to go into. Okay, so what does Mene mean? Yeah, that's a lot more.
We'll just stop you again.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Am I on?
Yep.
Okay. All right, so mene. Mene means weighed and measured, or to reckon by number. Weighed and measured. Belshazzar's kingdom had reached the point known only to God's long-suffering, but it had reached that point where God no longer is winking at his wickedness, and he says, okay, you've come to the end. You've come to the end. Not only is that true of Belshazzar's kingdom, that's true of any kingdom. That's true of any kingdom. That's where the phrase, his days are numbered, comes from. His days are numbered and they've come to an end. They've come to an end. So that's what mene means. Tekel means to be weighed or to weigh out. So Belshazzar has been placed in the balances of the scale of justice, and guess what? It doesn't tip into his favor. And that's kind of the false hope of the majority of lost men, is they believe that in the final judgment, when their good works and their evil works are in a scale, that it's going to tip in their favor. Is that true? No. No, it's not true. And then it says here... Eupharson, or Perez, means divided. Means divided. The difference in the wording is the Aramaic and the Persian usage. Again, that's something that only a Daniel who lived in the 6th century would use. So his kingdom is divided. It's believed by historians that they studied the history of the Persians and how they recorded their history and the Babylonians. It's believed that at the very moment that Daniel was giving the interpretation of this writing on the wall, that the Persian army had already breached the walls of Babylon and were at that very moment were flooding the streets with their troops of the city of Babylon at that very moment. That's what the historians have come to figure out. So that's a pretty amazing thing. As Daniel has given him the interpretation, the enemy troops are already flooding the streets of Babylon, his impregnable city that he was so proud of. And just stop and think a minute for Daniel here, this aged, godly man. He's facing a whole banquet hall full of people who have just seen this supernatural sign of writing on the wall, and he's giving them what? A message of condemnation and doom. A message of condemnation and doom. You know, I thought about that. You know, we like to talk about grace and love and forgiveness and pardon. We, you know, I'd much rather preach that kind of a sermon or share that kind of thing when I'm speaking to somebody about the Lord. But there are also times that you have to mention judgment. There are also times that we come to a place where we have to speak of judgment, especially to those who spurn the grace of God. Because that's the alternative, isn't it? If you reject the gospel, what is the alternative? And if you don't tell them that part of it, then you're not telling them the whole story. You're not telling them the whole story. And that's what Daniel was doing. Daniel was telling them the whole story. He was telling them about judgment. Judgment to come. And what Daniel said of Belshazzar fell upon everyone in that room. Everyone in that room. Proverbs 16:5 says, "Everyone that is proud in heart and is an abomination to the Lord, though hand join in hand, he shall not be unpunished." So everybody in that room fell under this condemnation. And what Daniel said to these people must have been like a thunderclap in their ears as they found out that they had been measured, they had been found wanting, and judgment was coming. That takes courage. That takes courage to do that, because that's not a popular thing to say. That's not a popular thing to say. So that was a very courageous thing that Daniel did. What does it say about the righteous? They're as bold as a lion. That was a courageous thing for him to say. And then Daniel 5:29, it says, "Then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him, even as the enemy troops are flooding the city, that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom." And then verse 30, "In that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain, and Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old." And we'll study about Darius in our next chapter. You know, if God has a sense of humor, and I believe he does, I think it has, I think it's got a sense of irony about it. I mean, stop and think about it for a minute. Here we have a Babylonian king at the end of the Babylonian time period. In the beginning, it was a Babylonian king that took Daniel captive. It was a Babylonian king that God used to tear down the city and destroy the temple. It was a Babylonian king that brought the vessels from Jerusalem to Babylon. And now we have the Babylonian king, the very last act that this Babylonian king does is what? To honor a man of the Most High God, a Jew. A Jew. That's going to be the same fate that's going to fall on all of the Gentile nations. Because what's the end of the story? Who is eventually going to reign and rule on this earth? A Jewish king. And all the Gentile nations who have resisted this Jewish king is going to bend the knee and confess with the mouth that he is Lord of lords and King of kings. Psalms 2, verse 4 says, "He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision." An old preacher one time said, "Man may have the first word, but God will have the last word when all is said and done." I'd like to modify that a little bit in thinking about Belshazzar. Man may have the first laugh, but God will have the last laugh when all is said and done. And that's true, he will. These prideful kings who thought they could rule in rebellion against God, God is going to laugh at them. God's going to laugh at them. Now, here's some interesting things you might want to put down. 100 years before this ever occurred, Isaiah the prophet prophesied about it. In Isaiah 13, 17 through 22, and Isaiah 21, 1 through 10. That prophet, 100 years before this happened, prophesied that this would take place. So that'd be a good little cross-reference. Jeremiah the prophet, even as he witnessed the Babylonian armies come in and destroy his city, Jerusalem, he even prophesied that that Babylon would be overthrown while throwing a party. In Jeremiah chapter 51, you can read all about that. He prophesied that Babylon would fall even while they were throwing a party. That's exactly what happened. Some 70 years before it actually took place. The downfall of Babylon is kind of a type of the downfall of a prideful and unbelieving Gentile world. And no nation is immune. Okay, and this is where I'm going to get a little sober. No nation is immune. Anybody know who Ann Graham Lotz is? Yeah, Billy Graham's daughter. Well, she spoke at the 2017 National Day of Prayer, and I thought this was kind of interesting. And what she did was that she had a prayer, and it was a prayer of repentance in regards to our nation's sins. And I'm going to read that prayer to you guys. She said in her prayer, "We confess our foolishness of denying you as the one true living God, our Creator, to whom we are accountable, living as though our lives are a cosmic accident with no eternal significance, purpose, or meaning. We confess we no longer fear you, and thus we have not even the beginning of wisdom with which to handle the vast knowledge we possess. We confess to believing that the prosperity of our nation is because we are great, while refusing to acknowledge that all blessings come from your hands. We confess that we depend upon our military might and our weapon systems to defend us from harm and danger, while denying, defying, and ignoring you. We confess that we have succumbed to the pressure of pluralism and our desire to be inclusive so that we honor other gods as though you are just one of many. We confess that we have allowed the material blessings you have given us to deceive us into thinking we don't need you. We confess that we feel entitled to what someone else has earned instead of taking responsibility for ourselves and our families as we trust in you. We confess that we live as though material wealth and prosperity will bring happiness. We confess our greed that has run up trillions of dollars of national debt. We confess our arrogance and pride that has led us to think we are sufficient in ourselves. We confess national addiction to sex, to money, to pleasure, to entertainment, to pornography, to technology, to drugs, to alcohol, to food, to television, to popularity, to ourselves, And all the while, we murder our unborn children to the altar of self. We confess that we have marginalized truth and mainstreamed lies. We confess that we have become one nation under many gods, divided and polarized, with license to sin and justice that often does not follow the rules of law. I think she's right on the money. No nation is immune. No nation is immune. Just as the great city of Babylon fell in a single day, there's coming a day that the Gentile powers under the rule of the last ruler will fall in a single day, when the Lord Jesus Christ shall return from heaven and defeat them at the Armageddon. And just as Daniel survived the fall of Babylon, so will the remnants survive that time as well and enter into the kingdom. Now, how did this how did this city fall? How did this city fall? What took place? I mean, he was pretty confident in this city. What took place? Well, there's a couple of ancient historians, one fellow by the name of Herodotus and another by the name of Xenophon. What they discovered, what they wrote, was that the Persian army had diverted the waters of the river, what was the river that was going? Euphrates. The Euphrates River used to run through the city of Babylon, providing it its water source. And it would run underneath the walls. And where the river would run underneath the walls, they had put these real thick brass bars or gates so you couldn't take a boat and go through there, but it would allow the water to come through. Well, what they did was they took the Euphrates and they diverted the waters of the Euphrates, and it lowered the river level enough to where the troops, the Persian troops, could get into the riverbed and march underneath those gates and into the city. So that was the Achilles heel of that city. And according to these folks, they also had special troops, special ops, and their one mission was to seek out Belshazzar and take him out. That was their only, kind of like the SEALs, right? That was their only mission. Once we get into the city, your job is to find Belshazzar and take him out. And that's exactly what he did. And according to the historians, these special troops fought their way to the palace guards, and Belshazzar had heard the battle going outside the banquet hall. And so he goes and he opens up the doors. And there before him are the special ops, and they take him out. And so he dies that night. And he died in October of 539 BC, according to historians. So just as God said it would happen, it happened. Just as God said it would happen, it happened. Again, Isaiah 47, 8 through 11, he prophesied that Babylon would fall in a single day. Kind of like another Babylon that's going to fall in 1 hour. According to Revelations 18, 17, for in 1 hour so great riches has come to naught, and every shipmaster and all the company and ships and sailors and as many as trade by sea stood afar off and cried when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like unto this great city? And they cast dust on their heads and cried, weeping and wailing, saying, alas, alas, that great city wherein were made rich all that had ships in the sea by reason of her costliness, for in 1 hour she is made desolate. Did I see a hand raised? Okay. So in conclusion, got some things there in your worksheet. Belshazzar is an example of an arrogant man, confident in his own works, nurturing a false security that breeds a defiant heart. Belshazzar was guilty of sacrilege and profaning the temple vessels, just as that future man of sin will be guilty of sacrilege when he stands in the temple proclaiming himself as God. And Belshazzar's greatest crime was sinning against the light he had been given. Sinning against the light he had been given. That's lost man's greatest sin, is sinning against the light they have been given. Belshazzar pictures the goat nations of Matthew 26, who persecuted the Jews and lived in the debauchery of the great harlot, Mystery Babylon. Belshazzar's judgment was swift and final, just as the Antichrist will be when the Lord Jesus Christ returns. And Belshazzar pictures the Gentile nations drunk in their pride, condemned in their shame, and banished from the kingdom. Okay. So that's it. Any questions I can't answer? Yes, sir. Last two. Swift and final. Belshazzar's judgment was swift and final. And then Belshazzar pictures drunken nations, their pride, their shame, and being banished. Pride, shame, and banished. Okay. Yes, sir. This time in history, what we are seeing, remember the image that Belshazzar had of the golden head and the chest and silver and the arms? What we're seeing now is that portion of in Gentile history where the Babylonian Empire or the golden head is coming to an end, and now the chests of silver and arms are now coming in into power. So the next power that's coming in, according to Nebuchadnezzar's image, is the Medes and the Persians. So that's where we're at in, as far as Daniel chapter 5 is concerned. Babylon is shifting out. It's no longer an empire. The Medes and the Persians are now coming on to that, onto that playing field.
Where did the Holy Land of Israel fit into that?
They're still under captivity under Nebuchadnezzar in the land. And with the coming of the Medes and the Persians, shortly after they come into power, that's when Cyrus gives the decree that the Jews are allowed to go back into the Holy Land. And that's where the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah come into play, where they go in and start rebuilding the temple and begin rebuilding the city walls and the gates. So it's Persia that comes in and gives the decree to allow the Jews to return back into the promised land. But at this time, they're still under the captivity in Babylon. They're still under captivity in Babylon in Daniel chapter 5. And then as soon as the Medes and Persians become established, then shortly thereafter, and we're going to see that as we go through the book of Daniel, shortly thereafter, then they'll have the decree from Cyrus to allow them to go back into. So that's where we're at. We're in that transitional time. Does that help? Okay. All right. Anything else? Whew, good. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. Let's go ahead and close out in prayer. And who can I pick on tonight? Yes? Okay.